This session's on congregations as community builders. And it's based on some things we've been talking about all week. Partly on an approach to community called asset-based community development, which advocates going into communities from the point of view looking first for and working from the assets. And the the sort of visual we use for that a lot is a glass that's half full and half empty. And asset-based community development says you start in a community regardless of its needs, regardless of its challenges and problems and deficits, in the half full part of the glass. You know, that it's often far more effective in making change and transforming lives to start with uncovering gifts of individuals, uncovering gifts of groups, finding the gifts of institutions in a community and what they might have to offer, looking at the local economy, including what kind of work people can do, and looking at the culture and stories. So an example would be when the North Coast here from Washington down to Northern California was economically devastated by changes in logging policies, many of which a lot of us supported because it stopped logging in old growth forests and places that we knew would take hundreds and hundreds of years to come back. At that time, the U.S. government's job training program was really targeted around retraining people in economically depressed areas to do computer data entry. Because it's late 80s, early 90s, and computers were the way of the future, so we'll train people to enter data into computers. Well, that didn't really take in logging towns. These mostly guys, there was no interest. Where towns were successful was they had lots of smarter meetings where they talked about what people were good at, what talents they had, and figured out how they could be used. And several towns in particular sort of stopped the sort of dive. I mean, logging was a very decent income. It was a middle to upper middle class income. It wasn't high wealth, but it was good income. Stopped the slide from that into poverty, which some communities did, by doing things like retraining loggers to do wood sculpture, high-end wood sculpture. That they would ship down to San Francisco to art galleries where people would pay lots of money. And I thought of this yesterday at the Jubilee auction of the Mavericks in Long Park. And I thought, you know, we could make a ton of money for Holden if we could just package this right and get this into the galleries in Seattle, New York, and Minneapolis. And it's, you know, talk about sustainable. Got lots of hunks of wood here that Mavericks could chop up a little bit with a chainsaw and write a nice story about and sell. Others
provide a certificate of authenticity.
Yeah. Certificate of authenticity, of course, was the key. What was it, the Holden Art something of Mavericks? So the certificate of authenticity was called Harm. Some work in the marketing department would be necessary. Another community learn furniture making with the kind of scraps you can pick up from the woods and sew it and bending it and fancy wicker furniture making. So the idea basically is that instead of going in and saying, well, your unemployment rate is 25%, your high school graduation or your college educated population is only 3%, and we've got some programs with what to do, reasons it works. One, it's totally avoids the burnout syndrome amongst people in helping professions, because you're not just doing the same thing over and over and over and going back to the same need with a new band-aid. The other is that it's based on what people can and want to do, and it helps them create things for themselves, which leads to a, instead of a circle cycle, more of a spiral out, because people have success and then realize they can do other things, and they can teach each other things. They don't have to wait for an agency or someone else to come in and tell them what to do, which many communities have been taught that's the only way to move forward, is wait for experts to come in and tell you how to do things. And the other is based on understanding this parable of the fish in a whole different way, the one that you have on the kiosk. So we all know how it goes, right? Give a man a fish and he's hungry for a day. Teach a man to fish and
feed him for a lifetime.
Feed him for a lifetime. In my 25 years in working in communities, the problem with that is when people aren't good fishermen. You can teach them, but how many of you have been taught something that you're not good at? I'll start. How many of you have gone in and to the pot shop, done a kind of cool things, and then you say, oh, I want to try the wheel. And the first time you see that thing just fly off into the wall. So teach a man to fish really presumes quite a bit. The asset-based community development approach first sits down and says, you know, what are you good at? Let's start there. Or what would you like to learn? Because it, you know, there's things that somebody could try to teach me. I have no desire to learn. If my end's economic future was I'm dependent on me learning to weave, we have a problem. Because I helped my wife on a weaving line. I did this once in a while. But yeah, I have no desire to learn how to really do that. Not at all. Or knit. People who knit, they amaze me. It looks like quantum physics to me. And I really don't want to learn it. And if I had to, I could. But if you came to me and said, I'll make you a better fisherman because I do like fish, then I would probably put more into it. So this model of community building is based on starting where people are at and what their interests are, what their dreams are, what their concerns are, and then hooking them up with each other. So we talk about it in terms of sort of two paths. Some of you were here earlier in the week recognize this. If you start with where a lot of agencies start, a lot of foundations tell you you're supposed to start, a lot of government agencies require by law that you start with a needs assessment, which is just a big way of saying I'm going to collect everything that's wrong with the community and mirror it back to you. And for the nonprofit, it also creates the dilemma because how many work in nonprofits in that sector? So you've probably been there where you get a grant to do something, do it for a couple years, and then grant renewal comes up, and the funding dance that nonprofits always face, especially if they're working in social areas, is you have to say, look at all the progress we made, but things are still really bad. And that's the way you keep getting funding with a needs assessment. Usually a needs assessment, starting with needs, leads to programs or services. So if people need things, we create services that meet those needs. And the role of the participant in this is what?
Client.
Passive, recipient, client. You guys can come around if you want, it's okay. Or I can shift here. But we are going to watch a movie for a little bit. So if you want to go back there, that's okay too. You guys won't mind if people step over you. Introduce yourself as you go by. So the role of the individual is the client, the passive client. But when you're working with assets and you've just spent a lot of time going around having conversations with people, learning what they're good at, what their gifts are, what they dream of doing and accomplishing, what their concerns are, now you have a different set of tools to work with. And, oops, oh, that was bad. The response to an asset inventory that a church does, that a neighborhood does, that a set of businesses do, is connecting. And they have all these different assets. How do you connect them in a way that they aren't currently connected to create more than you have already? To unleash some of the assets, to connect the person who's good with his hands with the person who knows how to fix bikes. In that kind of arrangement, the role of the participants are what?
More active.
Yeah, they're active, they're involved in it. You don't have to do this. You're invited to connect, and when you connect with other folks, you create something new. The word the Greeks use for it that's been totally screwed up in politics in this country is is citizens. So the Greeks meant that a citizen was a person involved in the decisions that affected their future or created their future. And a client also comes from a Greek word. Test this again. I tested it earlier in the week. Gastors. Anybody remember that? Yeah, you were here. the Greek that gave us the word client, it means one who lies prostrate on the ground. That's the literal meaning. Come on in. Some of my kids. Thought the universe was about to crack and they were going to actually come in and show interest. So, it's one who lies prostrate on the ground. And the way it was used in discourse was one who's powerless. The client was one who was powerless. So you can see sort of the contrast between the role individuals play in these two models. And it makes a difference. And outcomes, it makes a difference in the self-esteem of people who participate. And I really pretty much yet to see a people program, a people service that can't be done this way, where everyone's involved. I've seen soup kitchens and homeless shelters turned around this way, where the participants, be they the church member or the person who is homeless, are all involved in creating a safe place to sleep that night, or preparing and serving meals. There's a particular story about a Baptist church in Cincinnati that turned their entire homeless shelter basement kind of thing around by, after they did an asset inventory with a lot of the folks who were staying in the shelter in the basement, they put your name and say, Tom, and here's the things that he knows how to do and the things he's interested in and what he'd like to learn. A lot of times with homeless folks, it involved former careers and things that happened before, either divorce or alcohol or any number of circumstances led them into homelessness. And people started seeing connections. So the guy who wanted to learn guitar, it came out of a conversation, an asset inventory, would try to find the guy who played guitar. And it changed the whole role of the people who stayed in the shelter from people who were completely defined by the one aspect of their life, which is that they had no place to sleep that night, by many more aspects of their life. And then they saw each other differently I don't know how many folks have volunteered in an overnight shelter soup kitchen thing. You notice a little bit of the distrust that goes on between even the folks who are staying there. People want to want to check in their goods because they think people are going to steal them, stuff like that. That all went away. People started knowing each other's names, histories, backgrounds. Prayer groups formed, book groups formed. But the church staff went around one day and noticed that in about 80% of the sheets, kind of like these flip chart sheets that they had on the wall, people said one of the things they wanted to learn was to cook. And so they started talking to people about that, saying, what do you think that is? What's the, is it because everybody's hungry? Because we're trying to make sure you have enough food. One guy said, we want to learn to cook because if we know how to cook, we can be on that side of the counter. They didn't want to just receive food before they got their cot, which they checked out and set up to sleep that night. They wanted to be involved in giving too. They wanted an opportunity to give and produce. And so the pastor, Damon Lynch, the guy worth reading about, and you know, in Baptist polity, you get to do this. He just changed it. said, we're going to do this different. Now, people from the church, you're still welcome to work in our shelter. You sign up. When you get there, you'll find out whether you're cooking, whether you're serving, whether you're cleaning up, or whether you're eating. Sometimes you came and your only role was to sit out at the tables with everybody, eat, and share stories. And they would have, you know, kind of pulled in the dish team and stuff. You have your list of things, and you had, you know, 4 cooks and 7 servers. And same for the folks who came into the shelter. You had to agree you would do one of those 4 things. And they trained everybody on how to do each of the jobs. And so on any given night, it's quite possible that half the people who were cooking and serving were homeless folks. Serving other homeless folks and other folks from the church. And it began to develop a community. And it began to radically change the way the homeless folks saw themselves. It led to job contacts. Instead of sitting at a table with a bunch of other people who have no place to sleep, they're sitting at a table with people who own local businesses, who work for city agencies, and have contacts. So even at that most basic level of shelter and food, you can go from an asset perspective. And I bring that story up because it's an example specifically of a congregation. And when congregations decide to transform their communities, this approach often is very attractive because it's very easy to see the theology behind it, which is that we're all equal in the eyes of God. And so I'm not coming to our social service program from the view that there's something wrong with you and I'm going to reach down and help you as a lesser person, but that we're equals in the eyes of God. You may have a particular circumstance that I may or may not be able to help with. We certainly can have a conversation about it and see if together we can work on that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Anyone seen or experienced examples of that kind of approach?
Well, it's just like what Holden is too. It's like, you know, you come here as either a guest or staff, and I mean, this is my first time in Holden. I can't imagine being here just as a guest. It would, you know, being here as on staff, it gives you the opportunity to work or whatever and have, you know, provide food and shelter for yourself and everything, but you get to meet all the people in the teaching staff and then the guests that come. Yeah, that whole thing works as far as,
yeah,
you know, even in a non-homeless shelter situation, it's the same thing.
Yep.
So it's pretty awesome.
It's very Holden-esque.
Yeah.
And it's by no accident was sort of put together. I mean, this is an approach that just people started doing. Enlightened people just thought, I want to go this direction. And 2 guys at Northwestern University who were going around trying, where they heard things were working, whether it be job training or poverty reduction or education, went and sent graduate students around to collect the stories of those places and found common. One was they were starting from assets instead of from needs. It doesn't ignore the needs, but it says we're going to start here, we're going to stay here as much and as long as possible. And the other was that they were intentionally including traditionally excluded people. Intentionally including traditionally excluded people. And for different places, that meant different things. For some folks, it meant youth, bringing them to the table. Instead of seeing them as tomorrow's leaders, you know, children of the future, saying, no, they're the now. They can be part of our leadership team now. And we can train that. For others, towns that had traditionally white power structures, it meant making sure African Americans were at the table, and vice versa. For many places, it meant bringing people with disabilities and mental health issues in as equal partners at the table. And there was no exact formula to this, and there was no clear explanation of why this made it work, but they just noticed that that's one thing that was a common ingredient. Then they disappointed the rest of the world and said, there's no silver bullet. That community building that's successful and positive, we can only tell you those two things. One of those guys was Jody Kretzman, who's a regular at Holden Village, and regularly will say that the place he sees this sort of unconsciously in action all the time is up here. So for congregations, and we've decided that we need to do more than just have a fishing school to help our communities grow and connect and not be hungry in all the ways that you can think of hunger, but that we're going to have conversations with each other and connect people to create whatever future folks think of. We're usually engaged in what community organizers see and talk to the folks they work with as moving the world as it is to the world as we want it to be. So some of those conversations in asset-based community development, community organizing, are initially around shared values. What are the values we share? And then based on that, what kind of skills and talents and interests does everybody bring to the table? And then based on that, what do we want to do together? What are we willing to join with others to do? I work a lot with groups who put surveys out and ask people, you know, they'll give like a list of 20 things of what you can do, you know, volunteer at the library, to read to children, be on the neighborhood watch committee, neighborhood associations that come up with a list of things people can do. You get some folks, you generally get the folks who are going to do that anyway. But when you start getting people together to say, what's the world as we want it to be, which is certainly something as people of faith that we should be talking about anyway. We certainly have a whole Bible full of stories of people imagining this. Then how do we move, you know, at least in our own community, from here to here? And that involves, instead of a survey, going out and listening to people and what they might contribute to that, as well as the values they bring to it. So, there was one other. Oh, yeah. So then it just means that as congregations, we do have to deal with this often uncomfortable word, but doesn't have to be. Called power, because anybody who remembers their high school physics knows that an item will stand still until what?
Forces exerted upon it.
Forces applied, and then it can move. So if we want to get the world or community from where it is, where we imagine it, want it, dream it, pray it to be, we need to actually apply some force. Cruel force, it doesn't have to be mean force, but we do have to take the power that we have within us and Power just simply meaning the ability to act. We just have to act. And then we can start moving things. So some of the rest of this is about how we can do that, how congregations can do that. And one of the most successful ways I've seen, especially in larger congregations, is to do what we call by lead by stepping back. So instead of coming in to a situation or a neighborhood and saying, okay, we've studied this situation, which we have, right? Because we know that at some point some Senate committee has issued a social statement or paper on whatever situation we're doing and probably studied it. And we have these solutions. We open our briefcase and we get them out and say, here's what we need to do to make it a better community. Here's the fishing training program. Who stays around for that? Some people do. Who does? What's the nature of the people who stay around for that?
You get all kinds. You get servant-minded people. You get type A personalities that can lead from the front. And you get people who just want to help in various levels. Full response, usually in the full spectrum of response.
Yeah, you also get the people that are there to make sure they don't do anything, that are there to resist whatever change you want to make.
Yeah.
You got a few of those.
So you get service-oriented people?
Or you get people who are already in that area, have that area of expertise, where
right.
You show them.
Right. Which is wonderful because they, maybe in their work life or in a previous career, they had expertise, and now in their church, there's a chance to share it. Great. You also get people who are nervous about it, and so they're going to get in it because they want to make sure the church doesn't do anything they don't necessarily.
And our church doesn't do anything.
Or do anything at all.
Resist all change.
An alternative approach, and it's rarely do you get people from the surrounding neighborhood. Yeah? Outside of your congregation, so thinking of your neighborhood, your community, any other thing, how many of you have gone to a meeting before? Like a night meeting, voluntarily? Okay. Why did you go? Why did you go?
Two things, curiosity about how the community functioned, so I wanted to learn something, and I wanted to figure out how the church could work in it, you know, serve the community, connect with the things that were going on.
So you're seeing how your church could connect with what was going on. Okay. Other folks, think of a meeting you've gone to. It was a night on your own time. Why did you go?
Well, also curiosity, but wanting to know more people in the neighborhood and what they were interested in, and what any of the issues that were on the agenda that I was interested in, and where people stood on that.
Meet people.
Mm-hmm.
Others?
Mainly to get educated.
To get educated
on what was happening.
Just real quick, how many of you, hold your hand up, have some sort of regular night meeting you attend? Of some sort, either church or neighborhood? That was almost all of you. You are not normal people. people in community development, people in churches and faith communities, and trust me, I was doing this in a Jewish synagogue, you know, I had like 2-3 hands up. We're not normal, those of us who give up our evenings for meetings. Many people come home, they might say, I'll come to that meeting. But then they work all day. They come home, they get dinner ready, have dinner, help their kids with homework, and might, for the first time in 12 to 15 hours, be just sitting down about 7 o'clock, which is 15, 20, 30 minutes before the meeting starts, and about when they need to go. And when you invite people to a meeting, might be about these conversations and assets. You're not competing with what they were doing at the time that you called them to invite them, which may have been the dishes or work, where it seemed like a great idea then. You're competing with that moment of when they first sat down and finally getting some time with their kids. Which is why most people don't go to meetings. It's why PTAs complain that not enough people come, partly because they don't do anything interesting to everyone else. And we do that in churches too. So if we want to, a group of us in a church wanted to start to build community outside of the church property and in the wider neighborhood and bring people together, we commonly kick that to which committee?
Outreach.
Or?
Kids, youth groups.
Social ministry. Mm-hmm. One of those two will get it, right? So now the people involved are people who are either good and or interested in outreach, or good at and or interested in social ministry, which is great. But it's a limited set of skills. You just get those people. When you open it out to a whole congregation, first connecting with each other through conversations and learning each other's gifts, and then asking folks, you know, was that enjoyable to you? 90% will say that was great. You know, I got to know people that I've sat next to for 10 years and didn't really know. And then ask them, how would you be interested in doing that out in the neighborhood? Just sitting down, asking people what their gifts are, what their dreams are, what their concerns are, and would they be interested in coming and meeting with other folks who share those gifts, dreams, and concerns. Then all kinds of people can participate. All kinds of people. You don't have to be somebody who's inclined to outreach or inclined to social ministry. And it really opens up the gifts that are applied. It's a church, also in Indiana, I can't remember the town, but they decided they wanted to do that. They were only about 100 worshiping and on a good day, but they knew the neighborhood was very involved and lots of things going on in the church. But because of limited pastoral staff and time and stuff, they just weren't getting people connected into conversations. So they got a grant and hired a guy whose gift is just walking around and starting conversations with people. You can imagine him here, he probably OD. And he's called a wandering listener. That's his title. A wandering listener. He wanders around the neighborhood and has no plan. I've wandered around just one block in Chicago. It exhausts me. There's not a person he sees who he's not interested in hearing their story. And sharing his. Very mutual kind of conversation. And then he just asks people, based on what he's heard about their passion about, if I meet other people around who have that interest, would you be interested in meeting them or not? No? Okay. Yes? Okay. I'll give you a call. Writes it down. It's in his file. Next time he, each week, goes through all those and says, oh, look, I got 10 people who are interested in, you know, getting the park cleaned up or getting something started for kids in the neighborhood after school, fixing bikes so that kids in the neighborhood can have bikes and learn how to fix them. And goes back and asks those people, you know, when we were talking, you were really interested in kids in the neighborhood having and knowing how to fix their own bikes. Got about 5 or 6 more people. Would you want to come to that? People will come to that meeting. Why?
They're interested.
They're interested.
I'm geared right to what they
common interests.
The idea came.
Skills, what?
The idea came from them.
The idea came from them, yeah. Yeah. It's their own. It's what they're interested in already. They're going to meet other people with common interests and skills. And they're being invited, my two-part chart, they're being invited into a creation process instead of invited into a service process. So with that, we're going to just draw some distinctions. It's boring sometimes, people get a little offended by this, but this slide contrasts asset-based community development from, could you move the the traditional social service model. And I, when congregations want to engage in community building or even any sort of service, I think this is a really useful thing to look at right away. They're not exclusive of each other, but the asset-based community building model focuses on assets instead of needs and deficits. It builds from opportunities instead of responding to problems. And I've said a couple times earlier this week, these two are based on the reality that most of us who work in this field have never seen a need solve a problem. So if I'm trying to respond to a problem, focusing on needs is not going to help me out here. It's investment-oriented rather than charity-oriented. Which I think, again, speaks well to our theology as Christians, and especially as Lutherans, that it acknowledges that we're all the same before God. I'm not better than another just because they have maybe more obvious problems than mine. Its emphasis is on associations versus agencies. Associations meaning groups of people who voluntarily come together by choice. Rotary, 12-step groups, motorcycle clubs, book clubs, knitting clubs. People who come together because they're already together. They already have a meeting to go to that they enjoy. That's set. So going to them and saying, is there something else you can do or would like to do in addition to knitting as a group, a knitting club, can release all kinds of gifts and talents. A lot of times it's just a matter of asking, as opposed to an emphasis on agencies, which where you're constrained to what the agency mission is, what its resources are, what its protocol is, the sort of classic, we don't do that. Focus on community versus focus on individuals. The idea is here is by building strong community, individuals are strengthened in the process. Does not mean that if somebody has a problem with alcohol, that they don't need some individual help. But it does mean that we know that individual help alone won't do it. They need to be surrounded by a community of people who are holding them accountable to their recovery. And replacing whatever it was they were missing and using alcohol for with something meaningful. And community offers that more than anything. So the goal is empowerment versus service. The power comes from relationships as opposed to credentials or money or other things, which also means every congregation can do this. Because there's not a congregation in the country that's not made up of people, therefore not a congregation that can't form relationships and develop that power. Back to my sort of two paths, people are the answer versus programs are the answer. So you're first seeking people and connecting them instead of trying to figure out what program can we do that will solve this. And then again, this contrast between citizens, meaning people who participate in the decisions that create their future, versus clients, meaning passive recipients of something someone else does. Reactions to this or comments?
I have a question. If, let's say, a very simple problem, you need, people don't have enough to eat, and you're going to have a soup kitchen. Where does the money come from differently with the two programs? Say, or the two models, you went through the model on the left, where would the money come from, where would it come from the right? At some point there's money and there's, somebody's buying food.
In this model, you know, a lot of times you're setting up a food bank type thing that has serving going on. So you have somebody whose job it is to run around and collect donations from supermarkets, from restaurants, from working out to get the government food program stuff channeled there, putting out flyers and things in church bulletins saying if you have stuff, donate. This uses some of the same things, but is usually done more by a group who say, what do we want to serve tonight? Or not tonight, but next Monday, and what do we need for it? service model is based on a systems model, which means it's good for predictability, reliability, replicability. It's going to happen the same way every time, and it's going to happen. But it's not as good for the sort of creativity and unleashing unknown potential. Systems are good for making sure the same thing happens over and over again. Small groups are better at bringing out sort of the human element in the equation. So it's a little bit of a scary shift sometimes for folks, because you have to trust that people will come together and rise to the occasion. And sometimes they don't. And a lot of times in my training, I'll go to Philadelphia next month and do a training for 2 days with people who work for community development corporations. Some of them who are doing very empowering programs, and some of them who do a lot of services in poor neighborhoods. And they'll say, you know, we tried, we, you know, invited the residents to come and get involved in this issue, and we just couldn't get people to show up. The limits were that the staff had come up with some answers for what needed to happen in that neighborhood, and went door knocking and invited the residents to come to a meeting with the answer the staff came up with. It's very unnerving for them when in my class I require them to create a plan that will involve going around and hearing what residents want to meet on, what they want to work on. Because it's not always what we think the most pressing issue is. Earlier this week, who was here when I read the story of it's rats? Only two? Well, it's certainly worth reading again. Sent by Henry Moore, who you're about to meet on a video, a late friend and colleague. He was brought into I think it was Norfolk, Virginia, to help officials there. He had a long experience working in city government to help clean up a drug dealing problems and a public housing project that the mayor had run a campaign on, making sure that happened. And so he came to help them happen, and he came back and told him, you know, you're not going to be able to do this, because everybody he talked to in the area, they didn't want to talk about the drug dealers, they wanted to talk about rats. There was a concern amongst parents, the adults in the public housing project, that there was a lot of rats around. There was a big fear that a rat would get into a crib and bite a child. There was sort of a legendary story that nobody could verify that had happened. That was what was on people's minds. So he said, until you deal with the rat issue, nobody's interested in the conversation about the drug dealers. From the outside, everybody felt like, you know, the best thing that can happen for these people is to get the drug dealers out. But people came to meetings, they just didn't do anything about it. So they tried Henry's approach and started having meetings about rats and how you bait them and how you do different things to avoid having them come in your apartment, and then set up different little groups who dealt with getting rid of the pot rats and dead rats. And eventually, about 6 months later, the rat problem was gone, and people turned and said, will you help us get rid of the drug dealers? So the idea is, if it's rats and rats, people come to what they're thinking about. Except those of us who are just really into going to meetings, and then we come to meetings. They also come to what they're invited to. Most people come to meetings because somebody they know and trust invited them to that meeting. And so they thought, well, it's worth Erica's time, and she really thinks I would be interested in it. She knows me. I'll go. Or, I told Erica I would go. I'm much more likely to get my butt off that couch and go if I told somebody I have a relationship with than if I just, on the phone, answered to somebody who called from a committee. I really want you to see the story of Savannah, Georgia, where it's not a story about a congregation as much as it's a story about a town. But I want you to look in this story and look at the city and the role it played from the point of view of how a congregation might act. Isn't, regardless of how we might feel like our congregations are small and struggling and don't have a lot to offer, we are, in addition to a huge association of people who voluntarily congregate around a common faith or a common tradition, we also are usually an institution with resources, with a bunch of people who have talents and gifts. And so this video focuses on the city of Savannah as an institution and how they changed the way the institution interacted with two neighborhoods.
We're going to see a story about Savannah, Georgia. In Savannah, there are two neighborhoods I want to share with you. One is Kyle Brownsville, a neighborhood, an older neighborhood where it was primarily homeowners. Pam Jones is going to talk about how homeowners got involved and helped turn this neighborhood around. The second story is going to be from Linda Larry in the East Victoria neighborhood, a neighborhood that's largely renters and was built around the late 1800s. Together, they make up a strong Savannah story. A story about a strong partnership between community leaders and city government, how they revitalized their neighborhoods, how they engaged people using principles of the gifts of citizens, involving associations, and how together they strengthened and revitalized and made a vibrant community.
Savannah, Georgia, home to two neighborhoods that have revitalized themselves through the principles of asset-based community development. In the early 70s, the neighborhoods of Kyler Brownsville and East Victoria, like many neighborhoods across the country, fell apart and degenerated into dangerous, unhealthy communities.
The Kyler Brownsville neighborhood was at one time very vibrant, economically feasible community, very self-supporting. Many professional African Americans lived here. Skilled craftsmen lived in this community and raised their families. There were businesses here that supported the community, grocery stores and shops and barber shops, local restaurants. And as urban renewal came in and the generations grew and moved away from the neighborhood, the neighborhood became like many other neighborhoods in this country and in the United States. It became a neighborhood that fostered criminal activity, drug activity, dilapidated housing, and we found ourselves in a situation where we were losing this community.
I could see the crime around us, you know. One time we could have just used our door and leave our door open all night long, you know. Now everybody was locking the door, putting something behind the door to keep people from coming home. We could have sit on the porch and didn't worry about, you know, drive-by shootings or anything like that. And in the early 90s, you know, that's all we had. We couldn't even send them, we were scared to send our kids out to anyway, play, you know, outside. You know.
When neighborhoods begin to deteriorate, it can be very difficult to turn them around. Whether it's attracting new business, new residents, or government support. Once a reputation is established, all outsiders can see are the problems.
I used to be a mortgage lender, so I worked in the bank for a while. And when we talked about the homes and the money that would be given to people to help them get into the home, basically all they would need is $1,000, they would say, oh no, I would never live in that neighborhood. Even people who were coming out of some of the worst projects in Savannah, they're like, oh no, I would never live over there. It's terrible over there. Because the reputation had just gotten so, it was a reputation that was taking us a long time to live down.
This prevalent attitude is a fundamental reason why change is so difficult for so many organizations and communities. If all anyone can perceive in a community are needs, then all they see are problems that need to be solved. Thankfully, the residents of Savannah had city officials that were able to think differently.
The typical mode is to go in and say, we have got to fix this, and here is a linear path to that fix. And that linear path might pat a few people on the head, and then you move on with it. But, and that's okay, but you're not going to be successful until you go through that engagement, which is uncomfortable. Sometimes it can even seem to set you back. But once you have everybody on board, then it's going to be a better fulfillment. It's going to be more lasting. It's going to be more widespread. And then after that learning curve, it's going to be more amicable because people will trust each other. They know each other.
So the secret in Savannah was a shift in the relationship between the city and the residents. A shift that was the result of two very specific attitudes. First was the city's belief that they couldn't solve the neighborhood's problems unilaterally. They needed to listen to and engage the residents. Second was the residents' belief that they had a responsibility to each other and their community to lead the change.
It shouldn't be the city that solves it. It should be the people who live here who should solve it. It should be the people who don't know where their children are. So when you look in your house and it's midnight and your 10-year-old isn't in the house, that's you. You need to make sure that that's done because you owe that to the community.
To care about their own community. Don't just have the attitude that I live here, but I don't really want to be involved with the strengths or the weaknesses. Be willing to come to some community meetings and to get angry about things that are bad, and then to support those things that are good.
This shift in attitudes is anything but trivial. By recognizing the need for the residents to direct the change in their communities, the city's role changed from simply providing services to recruiting, supporting, and creating community leaders.
I was sitting on the step and I often tell the stories when I'm talking to a group or something like that. I was sitting on the court step and he came up to me and told me that they was looking for people to work in the community, you know. And I gave him a statement like, not me, because every time I look on TV, you know, and I listen on TV, they're talking about renters, you know, how trashy they are and whatever. And I said, that just made me angry. So he told me, well, you need to get off your butt and do something about it.
And the residents' attitudes changed from expecting handouts from the city to using government resources to benefit their objectives and goals.
So the city is there as a tool. The county government is there as a tool for us to use them, for them to gather information, to help us understand our problems better, to do all the statistics, to go out and find the grants for us, but also to train us how to do that. And I give the city credit for that. They do a wonderful job with the leadership academies and things of that nature. It's just so amazing to me when I see people who are sometimes basically illiterate, understand these basic concepts of government, concepts of social policy. It's just a wonderful thing to sit in a group of people and like, no, she doesn't have a high school diploma, and no, she doesn't have a college diploma, but she knows what she's talking about and she can get to the essence of what needs to be done. These are the people that have been overlooked through the years. You know, we have all these, what is it in our community, we have all the black leaders. I'm like, who? You know, where are they? Nobody told me. Nobody asked me. Our leaders are the people that get up and go to work every day, who catch the bus at 5 a.m., who go to the second job at 6 p.m., and try to figure out how they're going to care for their kids in the meantime. And those are our leaders. And it's each and every one of the people in these communities are the leaders of these communities.
So the city of Savannah recognized that success in the neighborhoods was contingent on community leadership. So they took an active role in recruiting and training community leaders.
You have to be pragmatic about it. You have to recognize that people are busy and so forth, but the way that we've done it is a lot of neighborhood meetings, block captains, all that, but the other way is to have training sessions, you know, if they can, in the evenings or in the weekends, where we have a community leadership training where they understand the trade-offs involved. But you have to be very practical about trying to get leadership, and you're going to have to realize some of the leaders, you're not going to agree with them. Some of them are going to go off in other different directions. It's just like any other area of civic life. It's not predictable and it's not always pleasant, but ultimately you'll get to a larger group of people who are fairly sophisticated about what can be done and what needs to be done in their neighborhood.
One citizen-based initiative that was developed with the city was Savannah's Grants for Blocks program. This highly successful program offers grants of up to $500 for any resident initiative that would enhance the community. Each year, hundreds of applications were submitted to clean abandoned lots, create gardens, build playgrounds, and repair sports facilities. But beyond these benefits, Grants for Blocks planted seeds in the citizens of the community. Seeds that blossomed into hope, confidence, and leadership. Seeds that demonstrated a real partnership with the city. For the first time in decades, the city officials and community leaders brought people together in their community and created a sense of pride in their neighborhood and themselves.
We have a beautiful neighborhood right here, you know, and when we found out that we had funds that we can use to help us with that, you know, we really got excited, you know what I'm saying, because we went to work because we did our survey in the neighborhood to find out where the community as a whole wanted to see different. And everybody had a similar, you know, they wanted something safe and something educated for the kids. And everybody just wanted to be able to enjoy their neighborhood in the whole thing.
The principles of asset-based community development emphasize that organizations can lead by stepping back. The city of Savannah and its residents clearly demonstrates the power of this principle.
So you have to step away from it while they know you're still caring and that you're willing to come in and partner with them, but they want to make sure they're the ones that are driving key decisions and that they are a vital part of leadership. Initially, that they have to be the leadership. They don't even want the mayor to come in and say, I'm going to do this. They want the mayor to say, I'm here to help you.
It's kind of like we're all warriors. And this is our war, and the general can't do it, the colonels can't do it, each individual soldier has to do their part. And I'm just a firm believer in that.
In a relatively short period of time, neighborhoods in Savannah went from this to this, from this to this, and from this to this. Kyler Brownsville and East Victoria have been revitalized and are now thriving neighborhoods with active residents and vibrant communities.
This doesn't happen. You know, there's somebody doling stuff out, but there's no buy-in from the people who live there. So it's cool to see how passionate the people they interviewed felt about what was going on.
I love the small grants idea. Like just how much you can do if it's people from the neighborhood, from the community that are doing things themselves. Give them a few resources to get that going. It's very powerful and hopeful.
Yeah, and Henry's talked about how, he did two things. One, it was a one-page application. It was very straightforward. But you could apply up to $500. And he knew if an agency or a nonprofit or somebody was applying as opposed to just a group of residents, if they applied for $500. What happens when groups of residents got together and said, you know, we want to, there was that one picture of the bench and the kind of triangle and the plants. And they costed it out. So I got applications for $273, $483. He also had people return in envelopes, $9.67 with receipts. I mean, he's a city official, $500 grant, he didn't care. But
other thoughts as you watch that?
I also think the shift, kind of paradigm shift from being a leader, a teacher, a person in charge, to becoming a facilitator is really important, that, you know, stepping away from the role that you have taken on to allow others to take it on. I think that's really what makes it happen.
Very much so.
I just was trying to think about how this applies to congregational polity. You know, I've heard people say that committee structures of congregations prevent things from happening. What you should do is have task forces. You have a task force that responds to an interest right now, kind of fits the asset structure. But it feels to me like you can do it either way, as long as you're connecting people with the things they are passionate about. Yeah, I just wondered if you had an assessment of how that means we should work in congregations.
I think you're absolutely right. It's not whether it's a task force or a committee as much as how it's a committee or how it's a task force. And there's a old joke that task force are just committees with a more specific purpose, time limited. But there's no reason why a committee can't annually decide whether to renew itself or not.
Mm-hmm.
This is a waste of my second Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
Or this should keep going, but we haven't somehow connected everybody in the congregation who we think has something to offer to this, so we need to rethink. I don't really think it very often has to do with structure as style. Going back to the facilitation tone, leading by stepping back, where leaders are providing support and encouragement and coaching and training instead of telling everybody what to do. Other thoughts that people had as they watched the video? Oh, yeah.
If I understood it right, the small grants were, I think, were called block grants, so I assume that is a geographical location, is what I heard in my mind.
In many cases.
Which is great. What's great about that, it strikes me, as it takes this larger neighborhood, which doesn't all, this block may have a completely different thing on their mind, or an eyesore or concern, they may have more kids, than the one that's just five blocks over, because often in those kinds of communities, people become very isolated, and they might not even know people that live four blocks away. And so it seems like that the power moving from big to smaller groups, I think, more work is being done in congregations, also with small groups. So I'm just commenting on that, as I wonder if part of that success was getting subgroups within the big group that all had the same concern.
Yep, that was very much a part of it. When they started the Grants for Blocks program, there was 4 to 10, depending on how you counted, block clubs in Savannah, Georgia. It had been just devastated by the 80s crack cocaine epidemic. And within, I think it was 4 years, there was over 400 block clubs and neighborhood associations, which Henry, up until his death, said that was the greatest accomplishment, because what it created, you know, the physical facade changes, all the housing changes, it was great. But more than anything, what it created was vehicles for people to come together as community and connect. And that's what made streets safer. That's what made people want to move into neighborhoods instead of staying in projects as opposed to going to neighborhoods. So it's that connected piece that's a big part of it. And we see that in the Gospels all the time, Jesus connecting people, inviting people who had been separated by social and cultural norms together. A leader who put women in the middle of his leadership circle at a time when they weren't considered full participants. He went to dinner with folks that seems like over and over and over he was saying, you know, first gather together outside of your boundaries, outside of who you're used to, and then watch what happens. So, just to sort of wrap up a little bit, the asset-based community development approach is thinking glass half full. And you can go back to your parent engagements. If I had more time, what I would have you do is sit down and reflect a little bit. Maybe you can do this on your own if you're interested. To think about your home community, either neighborhood or congregation, and what it would look like if you engaged yourselves and your community in this way. And the questions are, what partnerships could emerge? What assets does the congregation have in its individuals, in its groups, and as an institution? What other institutions are around that it can rearrange its relationship with? I mean, we follow a prophet, a God, who is constantly rearranging relationships, right? And so what could our congregation be doing to rearrange our relationships in a way that can unleash the power of the people in our congregation and the people in our communities to create something new and something good and something healthy? So if this were like a two-hour session right now, we'd break into groups and write those things and share them with each other and inspire each other. And I encourage you to take time here at Holden to think on those things and find people to share your thoughts with and see what they think and let them mirror it back to you. A lot can come from simply thinking about those questions of, what do we have to offer? Who are we connected with that we might want to rearrange how we're connected? Who aren't we connected with that might be good for us to know? And think about those before you think about how can we come fix the broken people. Because we're all broken.